Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is historian and author, Dr. Adrian Goldsworthy. This is episode CLXXX, The Fort. Adrian Goldsworthy is the author of numerous works of both fiction and non-fiction, and his most recent book, The Fort, tells the story of Flavius Ferox, a soldier from Britannia who is sent to a distant fort on the Danubian frontier during the reign of Trajan. I spoke to him about Roman forts as well as his book and the process of writing historical fiction. Here's Adrian Goldsworthy. When you look at a fort that's near, I'm assuming, where you live, let's say you look at Vindolanda, and you look at a fort that is on the other side of the empire over on the Danubian frontier, how much can you take from one and superimpose it on the other? Are the forts that uniform that you're going to see that amount of similarities?
They are recognizably the same in that you have from, develops really under Augustus and then in, under his successors, this sort of playing card shaped, rectangular but with curved corners. Mm-hmm. Fort with a broadly similar pattern of where the gates are, where the roads are, the internal buildings. Oddly, once you cross to Asia and beyond that, the forts are square. And we don't really know why this is, other than that people in that area seem to have been building square fortifications for millennia. So everybody locally just thinks, well, that's the way you do it. Far fewer have been excavated from that area, so we still have to be a little bit careful with this. But so they are seem to be recognizably the same, but they are just subtly different. But in Europe, they do broadly conform to the same pattern. But you have one caveat, really, in that only a handful of forts have been fully excavated, and that's only happened in the last few years. So even an auxiliary base that's maybe designed for a garrison of 500 or so, as opposed to a legionary base of 5,000, you know, which is obviously pretty big, really, it's only with work at South Shields, just south of Hadrian's Wall, and Vindolanda, just behind the wall, they are getting very close to full excavation, though not necessarily full excavation of all the periods and all the phases of these forts that stay on basically the same site for centuries, but are rebuilt and remodeled. Something that has revealed is that there are peculiarities. One of the problems is that we've come to study the Roman army with this great gaps in our evidence. And archaeology was seen as a wonderful way of filling a lot of these gaps. So for a long time, forts were looked at almost as giving us clues as to how the Roman army was organized. So there was a whole school of, well, let's go, we'll count the number of barrack blocks, we'll count the number of rooms in each barrack block, and then we'll calculate what size the unit was supposed to be. And then we'll come out with a template as this is what a cohors equitata is, this is what a miliary unit is, and all these sort of 500 strong, supposedly 1,000 strong, but probably less. Tying that in with Pseudo-Hyginus, this manual from the probably the second century that talks about laying out a marching camp with a weird combination of units in the field and how much space each one is allocated, how many tents you have to pitch.
Wow.
It's in the sort of Latin that, you know, you read and you hark back to, wow, how did I find Caesar difficult when I was starting it in school? Because it's you know, it's like a really dull sort of user's guide to something that comes with your, you know, badly translated, you know, appliance or whatever. It's that sort of thing. But there's a problem with that is that the Romans didn't build these things for our benefit. They built them because they were useful. So there has always been a tendency when you excavate a few little bits or you do a sample to sort of draw in all the gaps as you'd assume it ought to be and make forts always the same and rigidly the same. And that is clearly not the case. Now that we've excavated more fully, they are very similar. They're recognizably Roman forts. But for instance, there's one phase at South Shields where instead of being full of barrack blocks, it's full of granaries. This is something I've used for the fort in that saying, well, originally this place was built as more of a depot during an earlier campaign, and that it's therefore got more granary space than we'd normally expect. But it isn't just simple template, this is an auxiliary fort or this is a legionary fort, and, you know, this is how it works. You're going back best part of 2,000 years and a very different culture again. There are lots of ideas I have tried out with the fort and with the other novels that are drawn from parallels with other other military systems or other societies, or guesswork. You know, we get these hints at this, and then, well, maybe they're going to do that. So every now and again, an excavation will throw up a complete surprise, something we didn't expect. They found, for instance, a temple inside one of the 3rd century forts at Vindolanda. Now, we always assumed there would be nothing like that inside. It would always be outside in the vicus. Mm-hmm. There it is. How many other things in the forts where we've just looked at, we've excavated a few little squares and a few patches and a few buildings. How many other really weird things are out there that will surprise us when they come along? Probably a lot.
So that temple in Vindolanda is to Jupiter Dolichinus, and that combines Jupiter and a Persian deity. So it hints towards the diversity that you can get in a Roman camp. So how diverse was the military, and how far could a soldier go from their homeland during their career in the Roman army?
I think it's pretty much anywhere. You know, the army is lazy in that it will tend to recruit locally if it possibly can. The old ideas that you sort of stuck very strictly with an ethnic group, particularly for specialists like archers from the east, that looks less and less likely. On the other hand, we don't know how far away it was considered convenient to recruit from. We don't really know enough about some of the details of ethnic differences. You know, were there particular diets for some troops that would cause all sorts of problems and lead to mutiny if you don't follow it through? So it's a little bit difficult. At the moment, we've swung from the, oh yeah, they were very careful. Yes, you know, these units would remain distinct for years, to the, no, they didn't care at all. I think it's somewhere in between. And, you know, you get the impression that the Batavians, at least until the early 2nd century, are still pretty much Batavian. On the other hand, after that, the evidence is very poor because a lot of it will come from inscriptions put up on tombstones where somebody says, I served in this unit, and they give you an idea of where they were born. The problem is we have so few of these compared to the number of people who served that it may or may not be representative. In the end, you know, the word of command is in Latin. So you have to gain at least a working familiarity with that language. The army is very, very bureaucratic. It's keeping records of everything, most of which are in Latin, though in some cases you do get some Greek stuff in the East as well, but the bulk of all written documentation is in Latin. So the odds are this army is able to send people all over the empire, but the longer you stay in one area, the more ties you develop with that region, and the more likely you are to have more relatively local people. But again, you know, are you a local to Northern Britain serving on Hadrian's Wall if you've been recruited in the southeast? Mm-hmm. Are we thinking in modern terms of how people identified themselves? There's an interesting inscription from 3rd century Hadrian's Wall that mentions the Germans within a cohort that doesn't appear to be German. You know, so there seems to be a particular group, and you wonder, you know, do you have a century that you've recruited in this, or simply do you have all the people who, you know, in the same way people claiming Irish heritage might get together for St. Patrick's Day or something? How formal was this? It's formal enough for them to put up an inscription and identify themselves as such.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. A few years back, I showed a couple of historians who specialise in Wellington's army in the Napoleonic Wars around the army base at Caerleon, which is not far from where I live, and was the base of Legio II Augusta. And I was trying to explain to them there's so much of the routine of the army has been lost because they didn't bother to tell us the things that everybody understood. And what was very interesting is that going back just 200 years or so, there is an awful lot about the British army of that era that is never set down and has not survived. So they don't quite know. And every now and again, a surprise comes along as to just how organized a system seems to be that must have been taught, but that was never mentioned in any of the surviving regulations, was never mentioned in any of the diaries or the memoirs we have. You know, setting up alarm posts and putting out a map of when you camp at night and where everything goes, this sort of thing. It's quite an efficient routine. And they don't talk a lot about training and how it was done. You get lots of reports of General so-and-so inspected brigade exercise or inspect the battalion, and they did, you know, they put on a display. But what did they do? Now, it's striking that even with a society that, okay, it's Regency England, it is different, very different from today, but it's that much closer to us, and there's so much we don't know about that. So you're dealing with this, but, I mean, the army is mixed. And the other thing that's very striking is its officer corps. They are Roman, but there are plenty of Romans who never saw Rome, had no genetic, Italian connection at all, let alone Roman. But they've come along through the provinces, they've become Roman citizens, their family has done well enough. You know, auxiliary units are commanded by equestrians. That's the social level down from the Senate. Now, there are tens of thousands, at the very least, of these people around. It means you can have someone from North Africa, from Spain, from Syria, who could end up being posted right the other way, other end of the empire, to command a cohort in Britain, or somebody from Gaul going out to Syria.
So do you get material evidence of those sort of things happening? Do you get, you know, evidence of Britons on the Danubian frontier or people who are from Palmyra or that area turning up in Vindolanda, by contrast?
You do. I mean, it's mainly, it tends to be inscriptions. So it's, yeah, if they set up an altar or if they die. You know, the classic case of a Palmyrene is the tombstone of Regina, who's a British girl, former slave. She's Libertar et Uxor, you know, freed woman and wife. So this is someone, this Palmyrene called Barates, has bought this woman, freed her and married her, and then commemorates her. And she's depicted as this sort of Roman matron sitting in her chair with her, you know, her knitting, all this sort of thing, and elegantly dressed. This is found at South Shields, just south of the wall. And it's all in Latin. And she's a, you know, she's basically an Essex girl from just north of London. She's, her tribe is listed. Now, he's come from Palmyra, and at the bottom, running right to left rather than left to right, in nice. Palmyrene, in that Aramaic dialect, is Regina, the wife of Barates, alas. Now, that suggests genuine emotion on his part. Now, obviously, she's been a former slave. How much choice she'd have in the matter, we don't know. But this is a fellow who's come from an oasis city right at the opposite end of the empire and is there in northern Britain. And he might be the same Barates who's a... either a seller of standards or a standard bearer, depending on how you translate the Latin. He's either military or he's trading with a military or possibly both in the stage of a career. And again, you know, the auxiliary units that are raised, when you first raise them, they probably are ethnically that group that's in their title. On their first posting, and for the first decade or two, they are likely to be predominantly that group. So you get, there's an Angela of Britons on the Danube from, probably maybe Domitian, certainly from Trajan. They're even at the Adam Clissi monument, which is this cenotaph of over 3,000 Roman soldiers who died during the Dacian Wars. We're not quite sure. Opinions divided because it's part of this complex of monuments to Mars Ultor, Mars the Avenger, the war god in his, you know, aspect as the Avenger, commemorating a Roman victory, but presumably a victory in vengeance for an earlier defeat. And some of those men are Britons. So those are the earliest sort of British soldiers commemorated on any sort of war memorial in the world. Though the names, it's very badly eroded, you know. So most of this, we can work out the space, but there's a unit from this cavalry unit of Britain. So people end up all over the place. And at all levels, even the senators as well, are people who are posted all around the empire. It's quite rare to serve more than one military post in the same province. And somebody like Agricola, who serves all three levels in Britain, seems to be exceptionally rare.
So bouncing off the diversity that you get there a bit, one of the features of army life that you've included in your book was the sense of humour from the soldiers. And it can be quite crude and basic at times, and it could be racial. And we're missing that sense of humour from archaeological records, but it must have been there.
Some historical fiction and adventure stories can be terribly earnest and serious, even when it's just an adventure story. Now, all the soldiers, all the military people I've known have joked a lot. The humour is often very dark and can be quite grim, or it can be just crude and simple, but it's there because they are dealing with these terrible situations, and it's just this coping mechanism. You know, people tell you it's the same thing in an emergency room in a hospital as well. You know, there's just got to be that, you can't quite take it too seriously because then you'd just crack. So you make bad jokes. So I'm often proudest of some of the sort of the bad jokes in it than I am of the action and the, you know, the clever things, because I hope that gives it more of a sense of reality.
A lot of not essentially racism, just, you know, ribbing at each other about the cultures and everything like that, and casual remarks made about the queen, the lady of the camp, and stealing Sabinus's Venus.
and and putting it all around the camp. And there was one actually, there was another laugh out loud line. It was Ferox who made a reference to something being quicker than boiled asparagus. And I associate that with Claudius from Robert Graves' line. But, yeah, appreciated that.
Well, it's there, but it is in Suetonius. That's, I mean.
Yeah, I know that. I know that.
That's why I had the worry with that I'll invent things for a story that I'll then believe is true, because Robert Graves did that to me. Because the first translation of Suetonius I read before my Latin was good enough was the Penguin one, which Graves translated. Mm-hmm. And he translated it in exactly the same style as he wrote I, Claudius. So you add in the power of the old BBC dramatization, which I always recommend my students watch when I was still teaching. Because if you want to sort out who's who in the imperial family, it's so much easier if they've got faces and they're an actor or an actress you remember. You know, if you think, oh, Sejanus, oh, yeah, that's the captain of the Enterprise. You know, it's just with a wig on. But it helps, because otherwise everybody's got virtually the same name and it's really confusing. You know, you're getting to the point where actually, is that Suetonius or is that Robert Graves? I can't remember. And that's very frustrating if you start looking for a reference.
How much interaction do soldiers in a fort or just a fort in general have with the outside world that are considered an enemy? I mean, you set up a fort on the frontier in order to protect from something or maintain a road or something like that and have a presence in the area. There's the sense of the other there, but there's times of peace. You're not always at war. So how much interaction do they have with the natives, if I can put it that way?
Again, this is somewhere where we have to start guessing, because we don't have much information about what goes on day to day. What's the normal routine? We get the papyri from the eastern part of the empire. We get the writing tablets from the north. But that's still a tiny, tiny fraction of what once existed. And it tells you where soldiers are posted, where they're going. So the first thing we must remember all the time, and this was something that I think was sort of a slight problem for people working on the army for a long time, going back to this idea that we were seeing the evidence for the army very much as something to study, rather than trying to think of it as a living, breathing institution that is there for a purpose, is trying to achieve something. Sorry, Augustus the cat is now making his presence felt. there we go, Gussie. And he is the sort who will just sit on the screen and stare at it. So, sorry about that. Right, so... So, you had all these ideas that were slightly wacky, that they build Hadrian's Wall to keep the soldiers busy and this sort of thing. It was a certain mentality rather than thinking, well, actually, this is a big effort. Maybe there's some more purpose to that. First thing to remember is that this is not where the army operates. It's where it lives. Mm. The Romans, these are not castles. And you can see that by, even if you look at the plan of the fort that I've drew up for the novel, The Fort, but if you look at any plan of a Roman army base up until late antiquity, when it does change and they get smaller and better fortified, if you look at a medieval castle, it's the walls, it's the towers, it's the keep if they've got one, the concentric rings of fortifications, that leaps out at you. If you look at a Roman army fort, what leaps out at you are the buildings, the barracks, the living space. It's built to accommodate people to store things and for workshops, for a hospital, for granaries, for headquarters building, for administration. It's a big area enclosed by relatively modest walls. So the premise of the fort is in part looking at the exceptional. These were not designed for you to stay behind the walls and defend as a matter of course. They were designed for you to live, to be reasonably protected, but when an enemy appears, you go outside and duff them up in the open. Because you're the Roman army, you're the best in the world, and you're better than them. And the Romans tend to do this even when it all goes horribly wrong, because it's that mentality. It's this idea of dominating the enemy that seems to underlie a lot of Roman strategic and tactical thinking. They're often not built in the most easily defensible position. They don't ignore the ground, but often they are the most convenient for the transport link. They tend to be along roads, along convenient routes, because communication is important, because you want your soldiers from that fort to go out and do things. Now, in relative peacetime, that might just be escort duty. That might just be going off to work on a building project. It might be simply training. Again, that's something, we know the Roman army does a lot, but we don't know quite how it's organized. Again, a striking thing from the Vindolanda tablets, the main strength report we found there, only a minority of the unit is actually at Vindolanda. And it's very short of officers who've been posted away to do all these presumably nicer, more lucrative or more prestigious postings that might get you a leg up because you'll get noticed by somebody important and get promoted. In the fort, I wanted it to be very much the bleak frontier post, so they have less connection. They're in a mountain pass, and there are examples of forts like that in this area in Romania, although the one I've chosen is fictional, which just gave me the freedom to do it. There are others, but again, the impression is that there isn't a lot of civilian population in the area at the time because some of these have quite harsh winters. This is not where you want to be. So it might be an area where you have sort of transhumance and people come up, bring the flocks up for the summer, and it's occupied then or for hunting or whatever, but then they move away in the winter. Mm. On the other hand, that might simply be that there hasn't been enough survey archaeology to discover. You know, we used to think the area north of Hadrian's Wall was largely depopulated. That's clearly not true, as more and more evidence from surveys has come along. And there's lots of people there, which makes far more sense. Even another thing with Hadrian's Wall, we've discovered that most of it is built on land that was already under plow. So they're not clearing the forest. They're not taking a wasteland, clearing the area. This is taking an area that is quite densely populated and cultivated, and they're building this dirty great wall, cutting right through it.
That would have been popular.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I always remember... It was a cartoon postcard I bought years ago on Hadrian's Wall of this, you know, Roman soldier coming up to this little man with his hut. And you can see in the background this road party building this dead straight road that's coming straight towards his house. So I expect you've heard about Roman roads then. So there's interaction, but it's always difficult. Archaeology doesn't necessarily tell you the dynamics. So you might find, for instance, in Scotland, a Roman watchtower, you know, like a police station almost, next to a couple of roundhouses, a little farmstead. Mm. Now, do the people living there see this as, great, now we're safe. You know, good old Mr. Plod the policeman will look after us, protect us from any raiders. Or do they see this as somebody staring right through their door every day to keep an eye on you and, you know, perhaps abusing their power? We know of extremes. Roman soldiers did abuse their power. They did pick on civilians. But again, does that appear in our sources because the army is genuinely trying to stop this and control this because it's bothered that it will cause trouble? Or is it because, yeah, you know, we don't care? It's very hard to know. And because we're dealing with an empire, we're dealing with conquest, with occupation, all of these things are quite emotive subjects, particularly today. So that you have to be very careful how you're interpreting the evidence. And you've really got to admit in a lot of cases that either could be true. Mm-hmm. So I've tried to show a bit of... So I've tried with all these novels not to have the Romans as simply the good guys or the bad guys. And the same of the locals. So that's partly why the fort is told in part from the perspective of the Dacian nobleman Brassus. And yeah. I've tried to depict him as from a very different culture. Now that's problematic with the Dacians because we don't know so much about them. So I'm, you know, sometimes drawing on material from Herodotus, talking about cults from that same region. And this is maybe something he didn't understand, but there isn't anything else. Mm-hmm. But I've wanted to show that, you know, the enemy is a decent person who is trying to do his best and trying to do the right thing, and is someone who is troubled and who, you know, thinks too much than is probably good for him, in that he, you know, questions the assumptions he's been brought up with, all this sort of thing. But is a decent, brave man trying to do the right thing. But on his side, there are leaders who are corrupt, who are dodgy, who are maybe manipulating, who are not living up to this ideal within their religion of this sort of move towards perfection of living this proper life. In the same way that the Romans are corrupt and dodgy, some of them, and some of them are not. So it's trying to make everybody human. Not in a sense take sides, although inevitably our main characters are Roman and we care more about what happens to them. But hopefully people do care for Brassus and those around him as well.
There's a lot of, you know, nice details. Every now and then I will Google something because I'll go, is that something that Adrian's made up, or is that something from, you know, Dio or Suetonius or something? A couple of times you've had me reaching for Google. But then there's other things like... this is going to sound strange, but I'm a big fan of Apollodorus of Damascus. I'm very happy that he made an appearance here.
I try to introduce as many real people as I possibly can, and particularly someone like that, because, you know, you've got the bridge there, and all right, only that one pier survives. But yes. Again, with all the stories, I've tried to, where possible, tie it into something that people can go and see, or they can go and see a picture. because I think that makes it more real and makes the landscape, as I say, the fort in the Fort Pirabhorodhava isn't there. But, you know, you can go and see Vindolanda, you can go and see some of the other stuff, and you can go and look at Trajan's Column, and you can see that depiction of the bridge, and you can read Dio's account. You know, there's something deeply odd that they build this great thing, you know, and the work that went into that is incredible, and it's this incredible achievement, and yet Hadrian has it taken apart. They don't keep it there, even though they've got a permanent province the other side. That was another way of bringing in Hadrian into it as something that he really will do. So something where he's concerned, where he sees, okay, you've built this wonderful thing, but actually this could be a problem.
It was very, I like that comment. I think he made it to Piso that that you can cross a bridge both ways.
Yeah, it's that. So because, because you've got Procopius in the 6th century talking about seeing the remains of this, and wow, it's still, you know, the piers there still look impressive, but they've taken the bridge bit, the walkway away. Again, it's the more I could fit in, and part of it is, yes, some of it's explained, and I do have the historical note at the end for some of the sort of the issues, saying, well, you know, made this up, or this is where this came from, but also this is real. And, I found when years ago I wrote some Napoleonic novels, a series that I'm hoping still to finish one day if the publishers will ever let me. It was very strange, but often people would come up and say, how on earth did you invent this episode? You know, this is the thing that happened. And they were always things that had really happened and had come from a diary or a memoir or, you know, somebody. There is that oddity that the real things are often stranger than the stuff you can invent. And it's just nice to bring that richness in as much, to add as much that's real, because I know I'm going to have to add a lot that's... In the same way, you know, early on there's a scene where Hadrian goes to meet the head of the Frumentarii in Rome. And... under Hadrian, certainly by the end of the 2nd century, the Frumentarii have turned into this sort of espionage. Of, you know, they have confidential reports on what's going on in the armies all around the provinces. And they're sort of, they become quite a sinister organization. Up until this time, and still under Trajan, they seem to be purely there to organize movements of soldiers and particularly movements of supplies. And given that Hadrian is most likely the man under whom this started to change, again, I thought, well, he could have this idea... nobody else has thought of. Actually, they've got all this information about where our soldiers actually are and how many we've got. And they've got people coming back and forth carrying these messages. We could ask them, you know, what's going on now, which might be a bit more informative than some of the official reports you're getting.
Again,
it became just reading, going back through, you know, Mosten and Rankoff Exploratores, you know, the Roman intelligence service, rereading that. For another purpose, I suddenly was going through this and they're thinking, hang on a minute. And again, it's not vital for the plot, though it does help it, you know, it does work. It explains why it helps to build up this sense of why Hadrian is getting involved in this story and why he's sort of pulling some of the strings behind the scenes. But it's linked to something that then really happens. It just seemed better to use real people where I know there's something that ties them in with what's going on. But as far as possible, if I can get something that's actually in our ancient sources, I'll use it. And as I say, I'm a historian who's dabbles in writing fiction because it's loads of fun. I've got to try and be as honest as I possibly can, as accurate as I possibly can.
That was author and historian Adrian Goldsworthy, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. Adrian's most recent book is The Fort, and another, The City, will be released later in 2022. If you like The Emperors of Rome, you can subscribe to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like The Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You have been fantastic, and thanks for listening.